That picking up okay here? I think we can hear it all right.
Yeah. Yeah, there shouldn't be much noise in the background. It's a fairly quiet place.
Oh, no, this will be fine. Let's begin then by indicating that this is Jim Boning with Dr. Norman Hackerman in his office at the Welsh Foundation in Houston. Today is Friday, February 21st, 1992. Dr. Hackerman, the last time that we talked, we had you at the point of arriving at UT in Austin.
Oh, yeah.
And you had started the Corrosion Research Laboratory within a few years after you arrived.
Actually, that same year.
And we did finish about it. You're telling me about the what it was like when you first started out there, what is now Balcones Research Center.
Oh, yeah.
We also discussed a little bit about why you chose UT and a tenure track position over a, quote, safer government position with the TVA.
TVA.
And you started right in, you published a large number of papers in corrosion very early at UT. But I was also curious about a textbook in physical chemistry that you published, 1949.
Yeah. That's pre-medical physical chemistry.
What was the origin of that? Why did you do that?
Well, there was a course at UT for pre-meds. They were kind of forward-looking. That was early in the game. And it had become evident to a number of people on the campus that pre-meds who had some background in physical chemistry, that is, more than just general and organic, might have a leg up in their studies in physiology and other things, that biochemistry that they got at medical school. And it was already established, but it didn't appear each semester. I got interested along with a fellow named Matson, F.A. Matson, theoretical chemist. I got interested in it because I took it on as an assignment. I gave the course. And Matson and I office together, and we talk about this on occasions. I tell him that the textbooks that were available weren't much good. And he said one day, well, why don't we write one? We enlisted the help of Jack Myers, a plant physiologist with a good background in chemistry. He'd got his PhD at Minnesota, had courses from McDougall. Name's familiar to you. Did some first-rate work back in the early part of the century. Good thermodynamicist and a fellow who really understood the field. So Myers was, although a physiologist, had a lot of chemical background. He agreed to come in on it, and he was to be our sort of perimeter guy, tell us when we're outside the bounds of what the medical students ought to have. We wrote this little book. It was, I don't know, 200-300 pages, I guess. Matt and I wrote it mostly. Our part of it, we wrote out the baseball game. Texas always has had good baseball teams, and we'd go out there and sit in the third base line, and at baseball games you can write and look up, then write again. Myers did his by himself, and we incorporated it. McMillan was interested in it and published it. And I think there was a press run of 5,000, and those were used in about 20 places. We never put out any other editions or anything. But it was an interesting little book in the sense that it tried to tie, at a very early stage, to tie together physiology, biological processes, chemistry, and even theoretical chemistry. It obviously didn't shake the world since it went through one printing, but it was an interesting book. In fact, I've been looking for a copy of it recently. I haven't been able to find it.
Yes, we have a copy at Penn. I looked at it.
Oh, do you?
Yes, I looked at it. It was in the library.
Good. I might go up there and Xerox.
Well, I'll see if we can find a copy for you.
Yeah, all right.
If you're looking for one. I was curious about the response because, as you said, it was very early to be doing that kind of thing.
The students liked it. There isn't much question. I'd been told that it was hard to get the students interested in the field. Even the good these were the good students who signed up for it. But they liked it. As I recall, I gave it, I'd say, 3 years running, something like that, until I became chairman of the department, I believe. There were little or no dropout. There was little or no dropout, and that's a pretty good indication that students like it. I'd say that 30 or 35 people took it each time. The only reason we didn't keep it up to date is that we all had our own things to do. Mattson went on to do a lot of good theoretical work. He's the guy that does spin freak, quantum chemistry. Myers is actually a photochemist. His interest was algae, and my corrosion work had taken off, so we just didn't have time to write books.
Let's. There were some other things I wanted to talk about your research, but perhaps since you mentioned it, let's look at your becoming chair of the department in 1952. You'd only been there 7 years. You were only 40 years old, as I got the dates right.
38, I guess. I was born in 1912.
How did that come about?
When I came, Dr. Felsing was chairman. He had been chairman for a while. He was a typical physical chemist, worked, you know, with the thermodynamic systems primarily. And he had chaired the department in a very avuncular fashion. Discipline was a little different in those days, you know, it came up through the chairman. But the chairman was not a head. That was an important distinction. He helped. Kim, we're going to send some annual reports, Dr. Boning, as many as you can find, of the foundation.
Over the past years?
Yeah.
Okay.
Don't go back to D.C., but certainly the last few years are important.
Okay.
And he had been chairman for quite a long time and was tired. He was replaced, or succeeded, not replaced. He was succeeded by Robin Anderson, another physical chemist, who wasn't all that interested in doing the chairmanship. Now, at that time, there were about 15 people in the department faculty. The older ones didn't want to take it on. Anderson didn't want to keep it, and Mattson was clearly not interested in being a chairman. And while I wasn't particularly interested in being, I didn't mind it. So it sort of fell on me. But it was kind of an important thing for me because it crystallized some stuff that I didn't know I could do or wanted to do. Management capability was one of the things. You know, I had no management background of any sort, but organization in my own business was always the first thing, so that's what happened to that department. And the department, which had been run in a kind of, as I said, in a avuncular fashion, I began to run in a more organized fashion. Careful not to step on the toes of the faculty. But, for example, I walked down into the tunnels in the sub-basement of the chemistry building, which by that time was about 25, 30 years old, and walked back in the tunnels and found the remnants of a system, which is kind of interesting, just boxes and boxes of Jena glass, beakers, flasks, sidearm flasks, funnels. We want to send them.
Send them?
Mail them.
Okay.
Sidearm flasks, all sorts of glassware, which came about because at that time, any money you had left over at the end of the fiscal year, state fiscal year, you spent. Otherwise, you had to give it back. And the way to spend it was to buy chemical equipment. That is, you didn't throw it away. And Jena glass, I guess, was popular in the late 30s or early 40s, maybe. Mm-hmm. In the interim between soft glass and Pyrex. And these boxes of things had been bought from Germany and stored down there. Just literally scores of them. But while I've fooling around down there, I found bottles of mercury, lots of them, full of mercury, and pieces and bits of silver and gold and platinum, which had been used in laboratory in the physical lab, for example, analytical lab. And I therefore made a very thorough search of the place by myself and collected the mercury and the metals, and sold them. I think it was legitimate. I sold them, and I had about $10,000 out of the sale, and for the first time I had money to support research of the faculty members in the department, and gave them each whatever it was, $1,000, I guess. And that was kind of unheard of at the time, because you bought things out of MO&E, maintenance, something and equipment, for your classes, and you sponged off of that. That's the way you did your research. If you needed glass, you'd go to the freshman lab and get tubing. The research activity was pretty high. That's the reason I went to Texas. When I went down there, I saw about all the dozen or so faculty members had some research activity going on. Felsing was a set of physical chemistry. He did a lot of work with vacuum systems. He was constantly in the laboratory with his own torch, you know. You've seen. And the torch was bought either with his own money or was bought for the physical chemistry lab, and he was using it. Or both. At any rate, this money was the first time, as far as I knew, that people there had their own dough to buy what they need or what they wanted in the way of generally chemicals or glassware for their own research laboratory. So I became a very popular chairman pretty quick. The quick way to become popular official is to support some with money. Mr. Bush is finding that out now. So anyway, that worked out very well. And I continued that investigation. I then went up into the attic and found that it was a shambles, a very dangerous place. It was just full of abandoned materials. Dr. Lochte, for example, used to get crude oil and extract it for naphthenic acids, for the naphthenic acid it contained. And the residue would go up in the attic. you've been down here in the summer, you know. It's not cold up there, I'll tell you. And I'm reasonably sure that we were lucky that we went past the flashpoint of some of those things. What may have happened is that it evaporated during the colder weather. The volatiles went off, and maybe we lucked out that way. At any rate, I went up there and then decided there were a lot of things there that were useful, but I couldn't get to them. Physically couldn't get to them. So I scared the administration by telling them that they had a very unsafe building, and they sent the crew over and cleaned out the place, and we got more mercury and other metals. So I had a little cache of cash, which I was able to use for the second and third year. By that time, this was 52, 53, I had had a grant, you know, that I got in 46, and that kept on going. Other members of the faculty began to get research grants. And so I could step out gracefully and not support them any further. But for 2 years, I got them used to financial support, and then they went off and did their thing with grant proposals.
What kind of sources of money were available in those days, externally?
Well, ONR had started. By 1954, NSF had started. In fact, this place started in 54, the Wells Foundation. And then IH was already underway. So basically, they were able to do it. In addition to that, Roger Williams, who headed up the Biochemical Institute, had made an arrangement with the Clayton Foundation for the support of his biochemist. I think there were maybe four or five. By that time, the faculty was at 20, and four or five of them were biochemists. And the Clayton Foundation provided the support for all of those biochemists with a proviso that they don't go outside and try to get any other. In other words, it was an operating foundation. They literally paid half their salary and all their support, all their research support. So there were a fair number of sources, and if you're interested, able, and really aggressive, you could do pretty well. ONR, NIH, NSF, the Wells Foundation, and I believe the Office of Army Research, as it was called at the time, started about the middle 50s. And toward the end of the 50s, the AFOSR started. And the AEC.
Well,
because Dr. Watt and Dr. Morgan, both inorganic chemists, and Watt had been with Seaborg at Chicago, and Morgan, as a matter of fact, had gone up there also, and then went and got his PhD with Seaborg at Berkeley, a radio chemist. So they had AEC money.
What was the age distribution in the department at that time? Were there more younger faculty, or were the older faculty still dominant?
There were 1, 2, 3. Of the, say, 15 when I became chairman, 6 were what you'd call older faculty. If I were to be included amongst the middle group, there were about 5 of us and 4 rotators. We brought a lot of people in during the decade of the 50s. Didn't keep a whole lot of them on purpose. That is, we didn't do so well bringing them in. I guess that's the problem. And we did indeed contribute to the problem of publisher perish. Now, I don't think there's any question about that. Grants at that time, by the middle 50s, I had one for 10 years. And Mattson and I were consultants. He had a then Humboldt company, and I had a Mobil. And others began to do the same thing. So the sort of exfoliation from the department to the world had begun. And this may sound like old fogyism, but it's gone too far. Mm. Because he and I and the others there did not let the outside interest influence the inside stuff. We did indeed spend a lot of time with students. And in fact, till I became chairman, I taught either three or four classes every semester, as did all the rest of them. Mm. When I became chairman, I went down to two. I taught freshman chemistry every year from the time I got there to the time I left in 1970. The 8 o'clock class, freshman class in the morning was mine. Big one, 250 to 500. And then I taught a graduate class. It was either surface chemistry or electrochemistry. They would alternate. Madsen taught freshman, quantum mechanics, statistical mechanics, things of that sort. So I've sometimes, I or we have sometimes been charged with leading the charge off the campus. Probably true, but that was not the intent. The intent was to broaden our view of the system. As you well know, the faculty members were pretty well involuted. Mm-hmm. And outside, the industrial people looked on them as being fuzzy-haired or egghead or whatever term was it. Egghead, I think it was. Stevenson was around. Adlai Stevenson was around at the time. And I thought that my contact with Mobil and other companies after a while, Dow and Carbide and lots of others, made me a better chemist. Maybe not from the point of view of chemical theory, but from the point of view of chemical use. And I still think so. But I'm of the opinion that you can do that and your research and be interested in the students, and that those were synergistic one with the other. Now, I'm afraid the tendency is I'm now so busy doing outside things, I got to minimize my inside things. I think it's about to turn around again. But
I remember Farrington Daniels, I believe, taught freshman chemistry for many, many years.
Yeah,
as did. Well, with that same intent in mind.
Yeah.
That it required the best people to be in that freshman chemistry course.
Yeah, my philosophy was you could put a graduate student to teach in graduate courses, because graduate students in the graduate courses had to learn it by themselves anyway. Mm-hmm. Didn't matter. I don't mean you neglect graduate students by any means. My procedure for dealing with the graduate students was primarily in bull sessions. Mm-hmm. Without formality, without the threat of examination and that kind of thing. But I thought the full faculty members ought to teach the undergraduates. And that we did. I would say that those who didn't show a bent for it, we got them out of there. But the rest of them all taught. Dr. Felsing taught freshmen. Dr. Henze, who was a senior guy when I got there, taught. Williams didn't. Dr. Williams I don't think could teach freshman chemistry. He taught sophomore organic, which is the equivalent. So it worked out pretty well.
Do you think that was the department more physically oriented? Did it have a strength as in one specific discipline of chemistry?
It was as most of the departments were at the time, organically oriented. It had a very strong bias toward biochemistry because of Roger Williams, who himself was an organic chemist, sort of turned biochemist. and who never, who was always interested in biochemistry, staying in that department. He was a dead set against separation, which was taking place fairly regularly at that time. He said chemistry was what he wanted, not bio. So he was an important influence, and the younger organic, not the younger, the other organic chemists, Enzi and Lochte, were typical synthesis people or organic analytical people. The physical chemists were able, but there wasn't a great reputation at Austin. That reputation began to be made in the 50s, and it involved the strong input of the inorganic chemists who were there at the time, particularly Morgan, who was labeled an inorganic chemist, but whose interests were really largely physical. Mattson had begun to make a good reputation in theoretical chemistry. My electrochemical work was going well, and so we began to attract young physical chemists. But it actually wasn't until the 60s when we brought W.A. Noyes down. He had retired at Rochester. He came down, and we sort of put into his hands the identification and the sequestering of good young physical chemists, and he did a great job. From the time he got there until he died, which must have been about 70, 71. The department grew rather rapidly from 52 to the time I left 70. When I left, there were probably 35 or 40 people in the department. The fields had spread and now had begun to really lap over in the chemical engineering part, the biochemistry, and the biology in part. Well, I guess one place we really weren't successful, we never could convince the geologists to go strongly into geochemistry. Mm-hmm. They were good field geologists, but they weren't all that interested in basic science. Now they're quite different.
I must have been a strong petroleum connection then with the geology department.
Yeah. Mining in general. Of course, there'd been some, you know, there was mining out in the western part of the state in the early years, early part of the century. But petroleum was the main thing. But the chemistry department began to make a reputation that spread it, you know, moved it from the bottom first 100 to the top part of the first 100, I'd say 20, 30, 35. And from 1970 on, it grew even faster and better. But it got a real spurt in the middle 50s.
In your list of publications, there were a couple that you had identified, well, there were several that you had identified as being important ones. And I'm just looking again at this period for up to 61 while you were chairman of the department. Action of polar organic inhibitors and acid dissolution of metals.
Yeah, the reason I thought that was an important one was less because of its importance in corrosion than because of its importance in interface science. You got to remember, back at that time, the corrosion inhibition
was looked upon as anything you could do to put a three-dimensional structure between the metal and the solution, whether it was a paint film or scale or enamel, anything that would just separate the two. That's perfectly legitimate. That worked all right. But it didn't explain the influence of the organic inhibitors, which had been used from time immemorial. As a matter of fact, people used to dump egg white in, or molasses, or all kinds of things early, you know, in the 19th century, which clearly depended on the certain organic constituents of those natural materials.